I'm Jim Plackey, and you're listening to the Good Beer Hunting Podcast. Welcome to another episode of the Fervent Few Podcast. Every 2 weeks, we present you with this bonus episode of the GBH Podcast, where we chat with members of our subscriber community. The Fervent Few subscribe to GBH like a magazine, making a monthly contribution via Patreon. Members join us in a forum to talk about a wide range of topics that doesn't just stop at beer. And every week, we pick one of these topics and present the community's answers to readers in the form of an article posted to Good Beer Hunting. You can find more information by visiting patreon.com/goodbeerhunting. patreon.com/goodbeerhunting. Today we're going to call Kate Nolan, a freelance social media manager from the suburbs of Chicago, and Brad Reddick, a sales manager from the Dallas, Texas area. But before we talk to them, here's Michael Kaiser and I talking about what's been going on since the last episode. Hi, Michael.
Hi.
Hi, Mark.
Hey.
We're gonna chat. It'll be fun. It'll be great. We had a bottle share here on Saturday. What'd you think of that? You were here.
I was here for the first half.
At least.
Yeah. Before I went for a walk and called my wife and said, "You've got to tag me out of this. I've had my fill of booze and people." At some point, I found myself just wandering from corner to corner of the studio looking for a place to be alone and realizing there are no places because the place is full of people.
It was full of people.
And there were great people. I had personally just reached my limit of people.
You said that might happen.
Yeah. The older I get, the more I understand myself. And rather than pushing into uncharted territory, I rely on other people who love me to help me out.
Okay, that's interesting.
So Hillary came in around 6, and her and her friend Lindsay just cruised and handled the second half of the bottle share like the pros that they are.
They did well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was watching from the security camera from home.
That's kind of weird, but all right, I'll take it. I guess I shouldn't expect privacy at the Good Beer Hunting studio.
No, it's not our thing.
Okay.
That doesn't sound like us at all.
Well, now I know at this place we're staying on Saturday, I might be being watched from anywhere. From anywhere. I had a good time. Thank you for letting us do that here.
I loved it. I mean, I'm joking about the taxing nature of it, which is always the case for any social event for me. So it has nothing to do with how much I actually enjoyed the thing itself. It was super cool. There were some rad beers. Those beers from Indiana, Devil's Trumpet?
Yeah.
Those were great. Those were really great.
If you were to ask me right now what the most underrated brewery is that I can think of, I'd probably say Devil's Trumpet.
Never heard of them. Have you ever heard of them?
No, I was just in Indiana. That's why I was not at the bottle share. Where in Indiana?
Well, you didn't go to Devil's Trumpet, apparently.
Yeah, exactly. Where in Indiana are they located?
That's a really good question. I think they're around. They're not Indianapolis. They're more west. Okay. I have a friend who lives in Griffith, Indiana, and he's pretty close to the brewery. So the story behind Devil's Trumpet and why all that Devil's Trumpet was here on Saturday was because last year at the bottle share, a friend brought a bottle of their bourbon barrel aged stout and we drank it, and you watched like a wave of people going, "Whoa, wait a minute. What did you just pour me? This is amazing. Like, what is this?" And someone was like, "Oh, I brought that. It's Heaven's Court by Devil's Trumpet. They're in Indiana." And I'm like, "Well, how do you get that? Do you have more of this? Like, how do you get it? Like, we have to join their, like, reserve society." And people grabbed their phones and tried to join the reserve society from the bottle share, which is unlike anything I've ever seen before.
That's fantastic.
And my one friend who was here, the guy who got here first, he joined and he collected one of each of the super rare experimental stuff that they got while they were in that society and saved it specifically for this bottle share. Yeah. To drink a year later, and a lot of them were really big hits.
Yeah, they were killer. I mean, they were dry, maybe slightly over attenuated was the only flaw in holding on to stuff that long, but they were beautiful. I mean, the one I had beets in it.
Yeah.
And like the color of that thing was rad. The flavor was incredible. It wasn't vegetal at all. It was just like that crystally sugar thing you can get from beets sometimes. With like a little bit of fruit character. There was something else going on in there. I don't know. I remember being shocked by that beer. It was great. It was very memorable.
My favorite one is Captain's Quarters, which is like New Glarus Belgian Red, but barrel aged a little bit longer and with vanilla. And it's one of the best beers I've had this year.
You poured me that one. That one was, it was super interesting. It was unlike anything I'd ever had. Like, those flavor combinations were super unique to me. And some, I mean, in one moment they would clash, and another moment they would perfectly meld. And it was just kind of, I don't know, it's certain things when you drink them, they kind of vibrate a little bit, and in the way that they don't let you just settle in. It reminded me of that. Like, sometimes there's visual noise. Like, you look at things and they vibrate because these colors don't, they can't fit together, but they're somehow being forced to fit together. The same thing can happen with flavors for me sometimes. It's like, it just feels like they're in there and they're working, but they are just being forced like two ends of a magnet that won't touch. It was pretty interesting.
I will say I was kind of disappointed because I had that beer fresh and I really, really loved it. We opened that bottle and it gushed for a good like five minutes.
Was that the one that was gushing?
Yeah. And I think something was turning in that beer. It wasn't as good as when I had it earlier this year, which was a big bummer because I hyped that beer up for the last like 4 months. Like, wait till you try this.
It's amazing. Somebody, we put it in a bowl to catch the gush, and somebody poured the gush bowl remnants into a glass and drank it.
Yeah.
It was still delicious.
It was good. The other big surprise, I guess, I don't know. I just think we were all kind of didn't know what to expect, but we opened a 12-year-old barley wine.
That's right.
That was
the Goose Island barley wine.
Yeah, Icarus.
Yeah.
Which I had never heard of until someone told me they had a bottle of it. And I was like, I know where you need to bring that. And it took them 3 years to convince them to bring it. So I actually knew about that beer when it was 9 years old. And it took them 3 years to...
They grow up so fast.
And it didn't taste totally like cardboard or anything terrible. It had like a real good caramel flavor.
I thought there was a ton of cardboard, but I thought it was not distracting from the other great flavors that were in there. To me, it was all caramel and cardboard, but in a very delightful, surprisingly good way.
It was like caramel-covered cardboard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a lot of cardboard.
I guess if the flavor is half cardboard, half caramel, that's a lot of cardboard. Yeah, I didn't think about it like that.
Yeah. Well, now you're on my team. Do you know Mark?
Not personally.
No.
I mean, we just touched for the first time.
Do you remember episode 4 of the podcast?
Yeah. I was the first recorded, which I like to...
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. I was the test subject when you're like, come on down to the basement. Before I get real people in here, I need to make sure that...
Even I didn't know that.
Yeah, make sure the tech works.
That history's been lost.
Yeah. So...
And then I didn't put you out first.
No.
Oh, man.
That makes sense.
I must have thought I needed some... big hot shot guy
like
Van Havoc from Gigantic, you know, super famous.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think you went out. You were within the first 4, though.
Yeah, I was before you took pictures.
And Hunter Gatherer number 14,
I think so. Yeah,
that's it. I remember certain things.
Yeah. You remember half the things, which is most of the things that you can remember.
Yeah. So, podcast alum. And joining us with the first few.
Happy to be here. And Jim and I know each other on Slack, which is bringing the world together.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I recognized him, but we're going to Atlanta.
Yep. Yeah. This weekend we are going to Shelton Fest. I think we're going to have on Sunday, we're having a big gathering of just GBH folks after the festival. And I think we're going to have 8 of us there. I think that's going to be the most I've ever been able to get into one city at one time.
I hope someone can take that picture. Because you're going to want it. You're going to want that picture.
Yeah, probably.
Of 8 people.
Yeah.
So here's the thing with Shelton Brothers Fest. Is I know of Shelton Brothers Fest because of this podcast.
Ooh.
And I vividly remember those 2 episodes. The ones with you and Chris from the Beer Temple.
Yeah.
I remember hearing Shelton Brothers for the first time, Jester King for the first time, Prairie for the first time. I listened to those 2 episodes over and over and was like, one day I'm going to go to this Shelton Brothers festival. And kind of like sat there and was like, man, wish one day I'd go to the Shelton Brothers festival. And now I'm going as part of this thing is another very strange twist this whole thing has taken for me. Is like, I used to sit there and listen to that episode and be like, yeah, I don't. It's not like super emotional or anything, but I can cry. I can cry if you need me to. But I do remember just like imagining like one day I might go to this festival because it sounds super ridiculous. It's like all the best breweries and under one roof. And then I looked at the beer. I figured out they did release a beer list, and I just kind of wanted to be like frozen until Saturday and wake up and be there because the beer list is pretty ridiculous.
I really hope your plane doesn't get delayed, man.
It's going to rain on Saturday.
Yeah.
Well, what? I got time. I'm leaving at 6 o'clock in the morning. Not till 1 in the afternoon.
You could drive it if you had to.
Don't tempt me because I'm terrified of airplanes.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know I was booking. Man.
Really? Yeah.
Wow. We put you in the jump seat. You'll be fine.
Yeah. As long as there's a parachute.
So those episodes were interesting for me because a lot of those people I knew of but hadn't met in person or had a conversation with before. One of them was Chase Healy, who at the time was just with Prairie. American Solera didn't really exist. Maybe it did in his mind. But that was one of the... That particular conversation was one of my least favorite of all time. Because I didn't know enough about him. I didn't know his tone and like his energy, and like it just didn't click. But then at Rapier Fest this past year, I got to sit down with him for a second time. And then I think he knew a little more of what he was in for. I was kind of prepared. I was like, I need to make sure I set this up better for this guy, because not everybody's just like a natural like talker, right? Like not everybody just interviews well. It's not a thing you're born with. And so I worked a lot harder on that one, and it became one of my favorite conversations. Like he totally started opening up and like talking about other things that were important to him. Solera was a much bigger deal for him now, and like becoming really real and personal for him. So that was kind of cool for me to have, because I haven't had a lot of repeat interviews. There's only been a handful. So it was kind of cool for me to be able to compare those two and see the difference, not only in the person that I interviewed, but in maybe the approach to getting them to open up. You don't get a lot of second cracks.
It was a bummer because I wanted to listen to those two episodes and they don't seem to exist on the internet anymore.
What are you talking about?
If you tried to find it on a podcast app, it only goes back 100 episodes.
Oh, and then, that's right. They cut it off. It's all on the site, though.
Oh, it doesn't play. So I went to the site and those two episodes don't play. I mean, I don't know why anyone but me, but a weirdo like me, would have went back to listen to those two episodes, but they don't. Yeah, they don't. It's like they don't exist on the server.
We'll fix that.
Well, more importantly, that means they can't hear my podcast episodes. So like it's really good again. You brought that up.
Yeah. So...
Yeah, number
you're
four.
You're safe knowing that one's heard you in years.
How many times does somebody get click on load more? Well, that's good to know. We'll have to figure that out. We've been considering creating a sort of flash drive version of it so that we can send that out to memberships so that people can have, you know, a hard copy. We'll let people download it. But not everybody goes through the trouble of that, and some people would like to just have it all in one place. So
a box set.
Yeah, essentially. Yeah. I think that'd be pretty cool.
I could totally run with that. Don't say that's going to be a real thing, because I could totally end up costing you a lot of money.
Put it on CDs. Like, look at the old Miles Davis box sets.
Oh, man. Well, one of the things we want to do is, so our sound engineer, Jordan Stalling of Particle
Don't
Audio.
Don't say what I think you're about to say.
He didn't touch like the first... you know, 50 episodes or whatnot. And some of them you can, you know, are pretty rough in terms of audio quality, but I would love to have him go back and remaster those a little bit more. Is that the word you were looking for?
No, I thought you were going to say something else.
I think I know what you thought he was going to say.
What was I going
to
say?
Vinyl?
Yeah.
Oh, no, well.
Listen. No. You could release.
That's what the music's going to be though.
Right.
Yeah. So the tunes that Andrew Thibodeau is, you know, About 6 months ago, I just started posting weird shit to the podcast stream that I should have announced and explained to people, but I just didn't have time, and I just thought it was self-explanatory anyway, and of course, nothing's ever self-explanatory enough when you're changing people's habits, but we started posting those songs once a month from Andrew Thibodeau, who writes the music for our podcast. He's also my old freshman college roommate, and he was in Pattern His Movement. Now he's doing a solo thing. Like he's a pretty well-known artist. We don't deserve to have him doing this. It's beneath him in every way, but he loves it. We just started sending him beers that we loved and just having him drink them and write songs for them. And he's not a beer geek. Like he doesn't really know what most of these are, but he likes beer and he gets it and he loves flavors and he can interpret them well. And so we just started writing songs and sending them back to us. And we just started posting like one a month. And after a while, we realized like, oh, these are really good. And he's like, yeah, well, dude, I'm sending you my best shit. Like, and he's like, and just so you know, I'm probably going to steal it back and use it on the album. So our goal now is at the end of the year, once we get 12 of those, is to put those into some sort of vinyl, because they're only a couple minutes a piece, and create a piece out of those, which would be rad.
Yeah. Correct.
Then maybe I'll explain to everybody what the hell it is.
How do I download this vinyl?
Yeah. Well, somebody who actually knows GBH really well slacked me the other day, and they were like, hey, like, why was the latest podcast like just like a 2.5 minute soundscape? Like, I kept waiting for something to happen, and like and then nobody talked.
Like, it was a spooky sound CD? Like, there were way, like, doors creaking and windows closing.
And then I was like, oh, yeah, it's this thing. And he was like, oh, that's super cool. I wish I would have heard it with that. Yeah, he just didn't have the, I don't know, man. There's only so much time. Sometimes he's got to publish stuff and let the world work it out for themselves.
Oh, man, if you could press those on a record, that'd be the best. And include that in the box set.
Yeah.
So you get the music of the podcast, you get the theme from Good Beer Hunting.
There you go.
And then you get all the podcasts on a flash drive.
Yeah, you figured it out.
Yeah. Damn, that's awesome.
Then the remix album.
Yeah. And then we just gotta come up with like a cool slip case for it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, mm-hmm. God. These are things you've already thought of.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Hey, we're really excited. We're really excited to do these.
Okay. Well, anything else you want to talk about?
What are you looking forward to in at Shelton Fest more than anything?
Trying some beers from the UK, especially the ones that Matthew's always talking about. These UK breweries are trying to do New England style IPAs. Mm. That sounds so crazy.
Cloud Waters.
Yeah, Cloud Waters is going to be there, and that sounds so crazy to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to try those for sure. Prairie's going to have a barrel aged Christmas Bomb, and I love Christmas Bomb. I love any of the bombs, so barrel aged Christmas Bomb, I'm all for. There was another big one I saw. Well, Canteon's bringing 2004 Iris.
Damn.
And I just had Iris for the first time at the Bottle Share on Saturday. So to have like a week apart, if I could have like an aged version and then this like fresher version, that'd be really neat.
Hmm.
Maybe we should talk to some Fervent Few members.
Yeah, we can do that.
Okay. Hey, Brad.
Hey, guys.
What's up?
How are y'all?
Hey, it's Jim.
Hey, Jim.
And Michael.
Hi.
And Michael.
Jim and Michael. It's the Jim and Michael show. Talking to Brad.
Is that what we're going to call it now?
What's that?
Is that what we're going to call it now, the Jim and Michael show?
We're kicking around ideas around
the
office.
We're not doing
that. There's a lot of Post-it notes up right now that say different names we might do for the show. Jim and Michael show, Michael and Jim show, maybe.
Of them says lunch on it.
None of it has a chance.
I think you're projecting.
I think the lunch show was a good option, but it's probably not going to fly. I don't think
what does the lunch show mean to you?
It means trying to find the most delicious things for lunch in a place where we have terrible, terrible options, as discussed earlier.
I don't know if that's the image that Chicago puts out, when it's talking about itself.
That sounds like some guy from the suburbs who doesn't know that he's in Logan Square right now.
Oh, listen, my favorite restaurant is walkable from here. So let's relax. I know.
I mean, I haven't been to Chicago. I couldn't weigh in, but every time you hear about Chicago, it's some sort of food indulgence.
Bon Appetit's best restaurant city in the USA this year.
I mean, Bourdain makes it look awesome. Who's the other dude that did the Mind of a Chef series?
That guy.
You talking about David Chang?
David Chang, but then the gentleman, I feel like he went there from Kentucky or Tennessee or South Carolina.
We've got Rick Bayless and his daughter.
There you go.
We've got, did that reference not land with anyone? Okay, sorry. I'm just going to keep my mouth shut. We'll talk about that off the air.
Where are you from?
I was born in Irving, Texas, which is a little suburb outside of Dallas. It's where the DFW airport is. Then I grew up pretty much everywhere around Dallas. I currently reside in Richardson, Texas, which is probably the closest suburb to Dallas in that it actually touches Dallas and it touches one of the main highways that rolls north and south through Dallas.
Okay.
So it's kind of catching a little bit of a revitalization now. The homes are all from the 60s and 70s and 80s. And now dudes like me who got two kids and want nice schools and affordable homes that are being renovated are moving into the area. And We have nice little eatery options. I'm sure it's not on Chicago's level, but
well, when a neighborhood starts to turn down there, what are some of the telltale signs?
A burger joint,
fresh cut fries,
and not necessarily like a burger joint, and because I you guys would be surprised to learn that I might be a fan of burgers. I'm a fan of beer. I'm pretty discerning with my burger, but I don't mean burger joint like, you know, it's $5 greasy hamburgers and the same old fries, but like a burger joint where they're, you know, switching it up, they're adding some variants, they're doing their own special burger.
One of them's got peanut butter on it for some reason.
They're not expensive comparatively to what you could do for a burger in, say, New York, but they're not the value that a hamburger usually lends itself to. So that, if that makes sense, in that range, like, you don't want to feel bad that you spent $15 on a hamburger, yeah, but sure, you also like that it's in the neighborhood. It's much better than the $5 burger. But I would say that's a pretty strong signifier.
Yeah, sounds like you spent a little bit of time trying to figure out where you focus on your burger spending.
We have a lot of options. I don't know if you guys know. We like beef down here in Texas.
I'm trying to think if there's something in Chicago where I've gotten that dialed in. I'm sure there is. Probably tacos.
Tacos, you think?
Tacos, like, and tortas.
There's a good taco spread here. Like, there's the.
I was going to say a somewhat a strong signifier of a neighborhood popping off up here is a somewhat gentrified taco joint. If I could. Say that correctly without offending anybody.
Yeah.
Being that we do have, like, everybody knows down here, like, all the best taco joints down here are either like in a gas station or are in a part of town that people don't necessarily find favorable all the time, and that they feel that there might be a language barrier or something along those lines.
How bad do you want those tacos?
They're lovely tacos, and I have no problem speaking Spanish. I embrace it. I love it. But if you're talking about one of the things that shows you're kind of up and coming, you know, you got a burger and you got a taco joint on your corner with a little bit of mixed use, you're going to be doing all right.
Yeah.
That sounds wonderful.
I mean, are these burger joints and these taco joints, is beer a part of that equation in that area?
So the one here in Richardson, where I live, he just expanded to his second location, and he's a bit of a peculiar situation in that he certainly supports local. He carries a number of different labels on the package side. He's only got like I'm going to say 8 to 10 options available on draft. But the thing that's a little peculiar, that's a little different about him, is that he doesn't drink. So he's basically relying on having the one employee or the handful of employees that circulate through the distro companies to, you know, do right by him, because yeah, it's not like,
I bet it's his, not like he, I bet his margins are great though.
I bet he does really well, but he's also not one of these guys that's like, you know, give me everything that's under $140 a barrel. Like,
sure.
He's not doing that. Although locally you could be, financially responsible if you wanted to. You could hold a pretty tight line. I mean, that's not surprising that a local keg would be lower. But if you wanted a nice accessible style or something that people could drink with a hamburger that has a local name, it's not hard to do down here. To that end, I wouldn't say he's super focused on craft, but it does play into his, hey, we're a local hamburger joint. We're trying to support local. And a lot of places are trying to do that around here, just like everybody else. But there's not a whole lot of hamburger joints that I would say really focus on the beer. We got places that maybe might be considered like a brew pub. We got a couple places that do a damn fine burger, don't get me wrong. But that's not the model they're built on. They're doing all kinds of other stuff.
All right. I think you've successfully convinced me that the Dallas region does great burgers. So I don't think you definitely don't need to qualify that anymore. I'm on board.
if there's one thing that you walk away with, Michael Kaiser, it's that we know how to do beef and that you might be able to consume a carbonated alcoholic beverage alongside it.
Where are the good beef ribs? Because we don't get good beef ribs up here.
Where are the good beef ribs? I feel like this is a little bit of a patronizing, placating question in that you specified beef ribs, and that's a signifier that you're dealing with a good barbecue joint. So you've probably already gone down this list.
I don't know what that means. I just know we don't get beef ribs up here. So I just knew you.
Do you really not?
Not really, no.
Not that common.
No, we get it's all pork ribs. It's all St. Louis spares.
You guys are telling me you can't get a big beef rib and pay like $22 a pound and split it with a friend until you're ready to cash out?
Brad, do you know the price per weight of all available meats?
No, but a beef.
Because every time we bring up a particular meat, we immediately get into the economics. This is an impressive amount of information.
Barbecue prices are a sensitive topic down here. I know that Chicago once upon a time was the beef capital. I don't know if that still is holding true versus what we're doing down here. But if you want a beef rib that is as big as your arm, that literally could knock out two people without trying, you're going to be up in the 21 plus range. And it's not even close.
I got to lift one the other day.
Like the whole side, like the whole.
Oh, where were you at?
I was at David Byrne?
David Burke Prime House.
David Burke Prime House in Foxwoods Casino in Connecticut. And they had the dry aging room. He took me back there and he wanted to demonstrate for me how much moisture weight is lost over time. And so they had this giant shank hanging there. And he told me that originally when it came in, it said it weighed like 150 pounds or something crazy like that. And he was like, go ahead and lift it. I was like, well, I can't just grab 150 pounds of meat. And I picked it and I was able to hold it up like fairly, you know, easily, I would say. And it was probably, I don't know, somewhere around 50 pounds now.
What was the age on that?
Oh, geez. He said that was in there since 2012, I think it was.
That's ridiculous. I would have done the same thing you did, ask questions and take pictures.
Yep.
Share them with all of my friends, like, look what I'm doing.
Yeah, I think I ended up having a 20-month sirloin.
20-month?
Yeah.
Damn. When you talk about beef prices, and I keep mentioning them, those are prices I don't know. I am not. My age game is off of a cliff right now.
Is there such a thing as an age game? Man, this is great. I need to get way more into beef.
I gotta be honest. This is starting to like hit me in all the right spots. This is the perfect intersection of beer and meat and barbecue.
We haven't even talked about beer yet.
No, really. I don't. You know what? At this point, fuck it. I don't care.
I certainly didn't think we'd be talking about beef this much. But if I had to say, there's another topic that I'm happy to speak about with not near the amount of knowledge that I would think that I have on the beer side. No, aged beef though, that's expensive shit. Like you're living the good life. You act like you were at Foxwoods Casino in the aged room of beef.
I mean, I'm probably not going to be there ever again. Like, I figured I would just roll the dice on like that.
What do you guys, what's your steak chain do you have up there? Do you have a, what's the one up north that I always laugh at? It's called Texas Roadhouse.
Oh, yeah, Jesus, get the fuck out of here.
From
no,
Texas Roadhouse.
No, I'm not a steakhouse connoisseur. I've been to a few in Chicago. We've got some phenomenal ones here.
Yes.
Gene and Giorgetti's is one I've been to a couple times.
RPM Steak.
RPM my Steak. We do some good the dry aging up here. They don't have this patented process that David Burke was trying to sell me, though, which when I inquired really turned out to be more about the pink Himalayan sea salt walls than anything else that was going on in there. It was more, which last time I saw that, I was in a Korean spa. So I don't know how much of an effect that actually has, but it was beautiful.
And that's what I mean by age game. You mentioned, what did you say the other day, that was just so inaccessible to any other regular beer person? And you even defined it for everybody. I can't remember if you did it on Twitter. You said, what did you say? You said, this is what I mean when I say I'm into quality fermentation.
Fermentation quality.
Yeah. Fermentation quality.
Yeah.
And the beverages that you were consuming, they look delectable, but that's what I'm talking about. Aged game. Like there's guys that aren't going to Texas Roadhouse. There are guys that are only going to whatever, you know, boutique steakhouse is in there.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think I could eat anything younger than one. I don't think I could eat anything younger than 20 months at this point. That's just where I'm at.
It is going to be a severe step back for you.
Put that on a shirt.
It's certainly not going to go with your quality fermentation profile.
So that was really special to me, actually, as those bottles that I was drinking were, how am I going to talk about them? So it was a Pet Nat wine from Vermont that somebody gave me because they thought it was special. And I drank that with a Fable Farms cider. It was also a Pet Nat in its own way, with natural fermentation cider that was also from Vermont, and a Hill Farmstead. Was it a Dorothy? I can't remember which I was drinking that night.
I drank so much Hill Farmstead. I can't remember.
I just got back from there. I'm on like my month of Hill Farmstead that I get a year. All right. So leave it alone. But having those three things in sort of succession was really fascinating to me because I often drink back and forth between beer and cider or beer and wine, but not necessarily all three all along the same, you know, all along the same sort of geography, a little bit of, you know, maybe there's a terroir connection there. I don't know, but they're certainly all trying to produce similar kinds of things in the end that express this fermentation quality through natural fermentation. And it was wonderful. I mean, what a great night to be able to, what a great experience to have those things side by side like that and kind of realize that at some point, you know, if we think about cider and beer and wine as these vertical categories that are very isolated from each other, but then we realize that at that top echelon, when you're really talking about terroir and natural fermentation and that quality is what's coming through and that's what you're looking for, like that's a horizontal kind of category or identity that cuts across all of those things.
When you say you drink cider, do you have access to a lot of ciders, or is it because you travel and you pick up and cider is more prevalent?
It's a little bit of both. Cider is prevalent, that the sort of like baseline craft cider in a can kind of thing is nationwide at this point. But the ciders I'm talking about tend to be natural fermentation or champagne yeast driven. They come from orchardists. Like, those are the ones that I seek out. I'm lucky to travel a decent amount and visit those places and bring those home. I'm bringing those home as much as I am beer anymore. But Chicago is also experiencing this sort of renewed interest in those. So I can go to a place like the Northman up in, which is, you know, a medium-sized walk for me from my house, which is a dedicated cider bar, and I can drink those things either on draft or in bottles year-round. They've got Oliver's, Farnham Hill, they've got some of the Angry Orchard high-end stuff, they've got Easy Orchard from Salem, Oregon. And so, like, all of those things are available to me more than ever before, and I think that's because Chicago's kind of culinary view on food and beverage is pushing for that. It's created that opportunity.
The fancy Angry Orchard stuff we drank on Saturday was some of the most popular stuff we opened.
Easily, yeah.
People loved them.
I ask because, I mean, we get ciders down here, and, I mean, you can even go to the grocery store, and it's there along some of the grocery store craft options.
Yep.
But it seems to typically point towards, and I'm sure y'all get the same thing up there, it typically points towards kind of this crossover, oh, you don't really like beer, but you still like some of the charm that a local brewer or a regional brewer provides. But the actual ciders that I've had, I'm pretty certain I haven't had anything close to open fermentation or something like what you're talking about. They all ring so heavy and sweet.
Sure.
And they're just, They're almost in opposition to that bitter, crisp, refreshing taste that you like from any beer of a similar weight, if you will. Like, you're certainly not going to compare anything, up there in the high ABV to a cider. But there are some taste notes that I could see how you could identify in a Saison or, maybe some other Belgian styles. But for me, they just seem so heavy and sweet, the ones that I try, that I just haven't been able to get there.
Yeah, what you're talking about, to my mind, those are the amber ales of the 90s. I mean, that's what those ciders really are for me. Totally different world.
What you're talking about, that sounded awesome. That one Pet Nat, I went and searched that after you talked about it and after you answered a couple of my questions there. And that sounds, just from a beer geek process, just from the work that they obviously put in and the time they put into that, it sounds awesome. It sounds like something that would you could find your way to if drinking and tasting is something you like.
It got you hooked, didn't it?
I took a bunch of cider skeptics over to the Northman and blew their minds.
Yeah.
Like I just ordered like stuff that I knew was really good and really dry and, you know, natural fermentation stuff. And just, they said, well, this is wine almost. Well, yeah, it's apple wine, first of all. And they're like, oh, I thought you meant Angry Orchard and Woodchuck. And, you know, those have their place. And I think those definitely helped me get down the path to craft beer. But obviously we have there's different ends of the spectrums. And I definitely blew some minds by taking some people to Northman and having them try this very dry ciders.
Yeah, I take people to the Northman who say they don't like cider, and I immediately order Tom Oliver's Funk, because it is one of the more, it's somewhere between like the tire fire quality of a really interesting Riesling and a little bit of like fruit character on the finish. Gets a little goozy in there, like in the way that it, like the acid profile comes through. It's a bizarre ride to get on. And at the end of that, you either decide that you're interested in what cider has to offer, or you're just done. Like you were never going to try it.
I know tire fire doesn't sound like the most wonderful descriptor, but oftentimes when people say tire fire, I think of something that is well heavily mosaic, and I love that part of it. I know it turns a lot of people off, but if you're talking tire fire, that's a language I can speak.
Yeah, sounds like I need to get your address, man.
We gotta get you hooked up. No problem. No problem doing that.
Well, Brad, I want to subscribe to your Patreon about beef. That's what we've learned so far. Please start a Patreon about beef. I'll join it.
What's crazy though is like that's like a special time out for me. There, you want to if you ever came to Dallas and you just put out on Twitter like, "Hey, people in Dallas, where do I need to go eat?" Like, you're inevitably going to end up at a place that. And they're probably going to be multiple recommendations, but you're inevitably going to end up at a place that has a beef rib. If not that day, then at least one or two days of the week.
I think I have to come to Dallas now.
You're going to take your silly Flintstone picture of it looks like you're eating a dinosaur bone. Like it's just so funny that you asked for that because it's huge down here. Like if you're a barbecue joint and you open up and I said, and somebody says to you, "Oh, did you like it? Did you try the beef rib?" And you're like, "They don't do beef ribs." People automatically are ready to just turn the other way.
That's amazing.
Brad, how are you enjoying your time in the Fervent Few?
I really like it, man. It's done a couple of things. It's gotten me to have more thoughtful, not thoughtful. It's gotten me to have more drawn out, reflective conversations with Michael Kaiser.
Oh boy.
I'm gonna go. I'll be back in five minutes.
I don't know if you associate me with the times that we've gone back and forth on Twitter, which I always thoroughly enjoy, and I don't ever want you to think that they take on a contentious to a point to where it's not kind and or productive tone.
No, definitely connected. But I will say that having the difference between the ability to interact on Twitter and interact in the Slack channel for Fervent Few, night and day in terms of what can be accomplished.
Oh, and that's what I'm saying. So, and that's what I mean by a couple of things. And, you know, I joke, you run good beer hunting and everything, and you brought all this up, and you only knew me as a dude who basically was a profile on Twitter. And a lot of times it's flattering, and a lot of times it was contentious. But overall, it's, you know, from a point of admiration. So, one of the things I was already headed in a direction towards was drawing back from social media just because it's so difficult. And I imagine a lot of people experience this, but it's so difficult to not be reactive right now in any number of topics that you might be interested in. It's difficult to not be reactive. And I don't know that reactive is always the best place to be speaking from. So there's a lot of things that I liked about social media, Twitter especially. There's a couple of things that I've got to do that are really cool. There's people that I've met that have been just tremendously kind to me and answered my questions, and people who we have a huge sports station here called The Ticket, and it's been going for 20 years unchanged in its lineup. It's not like any other radio station in America, which I know sounds corny saying that, but a sports radio station that keeps its same lineup in place for 20 years without, yeah. 17 years without change. It's an oddball, and there's a strong community built around it. And I've actually got to, you know, meet and hang out and call the people who do the shows friends. And that's all because of Twitter. That would not have happened without Twitter. But it's turned into such a reactive, quick reflex way to communicate that it started to feel dirty, and I had already started to withdraw from that. And then I knew you were doing the Fervent Few thing, but I couldn't remember exactly. You posted a screenshot of, I feel bad for forgetting his name, the gentleman from Almanac, Josh.
Oh, Jesse Friedman.
Jesse Friedman. Thank you. I'm sorry, Jesse, if you listen to this. I've seen your name way too many times on a computer screen to not know that. And he was speaking with the guy from Wicked Weed.
That's right.
About, barrel transfer rates and how the, local climate affects what they're doing in the barrels. And I looked at it and I said, those are the conversations that I'd like to be a part of. That has depth to it. That has understanding of something that you're obsessed with. That has more than just, well, here's some shit that we could all throw back and forth at each other to it. And when I saw that, I said, okay, I'm in. If I got to contribute to that, to be a part of what I would consider better forward moving conversations, then let's do that. The other part of it too was that so much of my social media, and this ties into the topic we did, who do you follow? What do you like about so much of it was empty. So much of it was just beer geek, just needing to know who was coming out with what. And there was no engagement, no real care what they were coming out with, but I got to check the list by scrolling up and down. Oh, okay, this is what they're coming out with. I'm probably never ever going to have that beer. It's a small place in the middle of nowhere, Virginia. It's interesting to follow them in that it takes up my time to scroll, but there's no result from it. It's a time kill at best. So those two points are what I like about the Slack channel, and that I've found not necessarily what I consider like-minded people, but people who are as thoughtful and, for better or worse, as obsessed with beer, and they really enjoy talking about it. To some extent, it's a little bit of an echo chamber, just like everything else, in that we sometimes forget, how regular people, how the majority of the population consume and talk about beer. But at the same time, it's a good place to have an outlet for that, because even when I get together with my friends who might be what they think is as into beer as I am, this same thing that has just happened for the last 3 minutes happens, where I end up talking about beer and bringing out points, and it turns into some sort of the hot air me sounding obsessed about beer. And it's cool to know that other people are like that and enjoy doing the same thing. Anytime somebody's ready to, rattle off a paragraph about whatever topic we brought up, you realize they're probably in the same boat.
Yeah, they've certainly got the same attention span for it.
I would add
one element to that I think that you just helped me realize is what I, as a writer, what I like about the Slack channel that I don't like about Twitter is that for me, writing is a bit of a journey on your way to figuring out what it is you actually feel or think about something. And if you've only got 140 characters, you're probably just going to pop off the first thing that jumps into your mind that sounds the most clever or the most smart or whatever. And it becomes a little bit of, just a quick back and forth. There's no depth to it. But what happens is it's not just that we get to write to each other in longer form and express more of our thoughts in the Slack channel. It's that length allows you to write your way to your own understanding first. And I think that prepares you for other people's responses in a way that makes you a lot more open to what you're about to read next. You're not just looking for the next thing to, you know, to jump into with 140 characters and pop off again. So I don't know. I think that might be what it is for me that I really enjoy about that exchange, is that it happens at a pace that's slower and more open and more vulnerable than it otherwise would be. And I've really appreciated it.
It might sound silly to say this. Sometimes when a big happening in the beer world goes down and you pop off, let's call it 10 tweets in a row in response to you thread on Twitter. I went from thinking, call it like 6 or 7 months ago when I followed you, hey, this guy says that he knows everything, to, oh, let me read this and watch this guy work through this. And that's what I feel like those threads turn into, is that you're working your way through it. And on Twitter, because there's so much other conversation, I think a lot of people who might read that thread, it gets lost in the sauce.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe they're able to parse it all together. Maybe they don't actually thread the whole thing and read it as one piece. Most of the time when that happens, I do. But I thought that about you.
Yeah, that's interesting to know that it evolved that way.
And I didn't necessarily feel that way maybe 6, 7 months, a year ago.
Hmm. Yeah, sounds like you're.
I don't know if that's complimentary or an evolution on my part, but I think we've both done a good job, is what I'm saying, Mike. You've done a good job threading the tweets, and I've done a good job about shutting up and listening.
I think it's a signal that you and I are probably looking for the same thing right now. I don't know. Since we started the Fervent Few, I honestly didn't know that it was going to matter to me the way that it does now. I thought it would just be cool to have a place where, you know, subscribers can come and meet each other and talk and that kind of thing. I didn't expect it to so satisfactorily replace the stuff that I was looking for on social media that I wasn't able to find anymore. And that was that sort of more conversational thinking through things, asking questions, being curious about stuff, talking to people that are, you know, as passionate about something as I am and know pieces of it that I don't know. It's sucked me away from a lot of that interaction, just through its appeal. I just don't have a lot of time left over to do that stuff as much as I used to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree. Once you step back and you start having what you consider more, you know, productive or more engaging, not just the tip of the spear that you released quickly, you realize what your time's going towards, how much of it you actually have.
Yeah, and you're going to get some ciders out of it, I think. That's how that's going to work out. That would have never happened on Twitter.
Score all the way around.
Well, thanks for joining us, man. This was awesome. I'm glad to get to know you a little bit better.
No, I'm glad to be on. Please call me next week. We'll do it again.
We won't even record it.
You're in charge now.
Well, Brett,
awesome.
Thank you for joining us on
All right.
Beef Time Bye, with Michael and Jim.
It did become lunch, didn't it?
The lunch show. Michael and Jim, Brad talking about beef.
All right, man. Have a good weekend.
All right. Y'all take care.
Later.
Hello.
Hi, Kate.
Hello.
Hi.
Welcome back to the show.
Yeah. Our deepest apologies for screwing up the first one and losing the interview entirely.
For anyone who listened to episode 3 of the Fervent Few podcast and wondered what we were talking about with Chris some of the time, it was that we had a failed to record call with Kate.
Oh. Tell us about yourself. Where are you from?
Well, I'm from the western suburbs of Chicago. I have basically been born and grown up here. So I will never say I'm a Chicagoan because I know some people get very particular about that.
Yeah, you're one of the enlightened suburbanites. You've been paying attention. You're not supposed to say that.
Nope.
When you cross the city,
in trouble with some people.
When you cross the city limits, do you call it downtown?
No, I just call it the city.
Oh, okay, that's good. Because I have friends who call it downtown. I'm going downtown. Oh, what are you gonna do downtown? I'm going to a Cubs game. That's not downtown. that's near downtown. You're close. I mean, you can see it from there, but it's not downtown.
They have these things called neighborhoods.
Right. More than one.
They're kind of like suburbs, but they're not. Don't ever say that because you'll really get in trouble then.
Where do you drink when you're out there?
I am actually drinking right now, if you can see.
Yeah.
A Omegang's Hennepin Saison.
Oh, man. An OG Saison in the U.S.
That's a good one. I went to a Belgian beer bar in Madison, and that's what I drank because I was like, well, this is clearly what I'm supposed to be drinking in a Belgian beer bar in Madison.
Yeah.
I guess I didn't know my Belgian beers back then. I probably saw funny words, and I was like, I don't know what these words are.
First time I ever tried to order an Omegang. I think I went to Quenchers here in Chicago. This is 12 years ago, and I ordered an Omegang.
Okay.
And he just looked at me, and he was like, a what? I was like, an Omegang. And he was like, what are you saying? And I was like, that one from Cooperstown, New York. He's like, oh, an Omegang. I was like, yeah.
I thought it was Omegang. It's not?
I just found it to be appalling.
I really believe that there needs to be a like a beer pronunciation dictionary.
I would argue for more hospitable bartenders. I think that would solve more of the problem.
You thought maybe there'd be someone more hospitable at Quencher's Saloon?
Hey, you don't know what you're getting into.
Okay.
I mean, they have how many beers from around the world?
It's true. My dad, the only...
If somebody walked in there and said, could I get a Budweiser? I think he would have gotten me a Bud.
Probably.
Yeah. Just saying. It's not that much of a stretch.
I guess my dad used to hang out there. And he said, this is the place that had funny words beers. And we just wanted Miller Lite. And guess what? 30, 40 years later, it's still just all he wants is a Miller Lite. Mm. Kate, we just changed the weekly topic to bottle share or to waiting in line for beer.
Yes.
And you messaged me and you said, I don't do that. If it happens, it happens. So what's your best story of it happened and it happened?
I have a friend of a friend who used to work at AB InBev, who had a whole stash of beers in his fridge. And when he went to travel Europe a couple weeks ago, he decided to just empty out his fridge. So we got a whole bunch of sours. We got to try the original King Henry from Goose Island.
Not bad.
So. Damn. I guess that's a little bit more about, you know, 6 degrees of separation, but.
Yeah, that's a score. That's like King Henry. It's like an inheritance.
Yeah, yeah, that's impressive. There's a lot of people would be really impressed. I mean, not as impressive as a 12-year-old Goose Island barley wine that we drank a few days ago, but yeah, I guess it's okay. I guess it's all right. No, King Henry's a really good beer. It's probably better.
I don't know. If you can't remember you drank it, did it really happen, Jim?
There's only a handful of beers I don't remember drinking.
Gotcha.
There was a moment where it clearly, somehow clearly, it came into focus that I definitely should be done drinking.
Yeah.
I stopped drinking pretty early at the bottle share. That's how I was able to still go to long.
Hillary said that at some point you said, I need to stop drinking. I really want a highball.
Listen, maybe I said that.
And that's when she thought it was over. And she was excited. It didn't happen, though.
She was a lovely hostess and wanted us gone real bad.
Yeah.
Wanted us out of here real bad.
Last time we had you on, we talked about social media.
Yes.
And that's because it has a lot to do with what you do for a living. Can you describe what you do for a living?
Yeah. So I am a freelance social media manager. I do manage social media for a couple of B2B clients. So a lot of manufacturing and product related kind of things.
And what's the what are the hot topics of debate in the B2B Twitter world?
What are the good hashtags?
For the most part, they don't even know hashtags these particular crowds.
I mean, so what is it like when you switch over from your B2B social media world into the beer Twitter world? Like, do you get tense when you switch over? Do you get excited? You know, like, what is it?
I just try not to get run over because sometimes I don't have very strong opinions and there are a lot of strong opinions.
Yeah, that's par for the course over there. What are some of the things that you've seen people arguing about on beer Twitter lately?
Well, I was told Jim earlier that I was looking at Goose Island to review how their infected beer situation went down last year. So I was looking at some of their new, and it's still coming up for them in August of 2017.
As
showed pictures of their bottling line, someone's like, well, hope it isn't infected.
Yeah. Oh, man, that person thinks they wrote the funniest joke.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. That's brutal.
Their jokes last a long time. Like the people who think that this is the first time that they've told them I hope that beer's not infected, or I hope it doesn't taste like Budweiser. Like, that person thinks they like logged off and like, yeah, nailed it.
Totally. Patting themselves on the back like, I am so witty.
Yeah. Well, what were you looking back at that old stuff for? Just to see how long they live?
You know, it was actually because of the scofflaw post that was in the Slack channel. I was trying to remember some other big beer controversy that might have played out on social media.
What was the scofflaw post? I missed that. Catch me up.
So they were getting some crap for cans exploding and beers tasting different even in the same six-pack.
Oh, no kidding.
And the owner wrote a terse response on Facebook saying that, like, this is how, you know, we work with real grains and real hops. And, you know, if you want to drink a beer that tastes the same every time you drink it, we can give you some examples. I bet you can guess those examples. Budweiser, Coors Light, et cetera. It was very terse. And so we kind of had some debate around that.
I don't know. As a social media professional, how would you handle a situation like that, Kate?
There's two options. Is it the situation one where my owner has gone and posted something like that, or is it when we're having quality issues? And
let's start with the latter. Let's start with quality issues. How would you go about handling that if you were a brewery?
Quality issues. I think I don't know how old Scofflaw is because they are not in my.
Yeah, I didn't really know who Scofflaw was.
Assuming they're relatively new, I would just take an upbeat approach and say, listen, we never knew what kind of challenges we'd run into. Here's what we're having. We really appreciate you guys sticking around while we figure it out. You know, come in and visit us and we'll help you out and find you something else.
Yeah. Yeah. What would you do if the owner was already out there taking swings?
I would take his password away.
Yeah. There's a lot of that going around.
Someone should take your password away.
It's probably true.
Okay.
I mean, you're not going to get an argument out of it.
Okay. I took a swing on that one. Thought maybe we'd debate that a little bit, but nope.
No, you should
definitely not.
Nothing but clarity over here. I don't know what you thought you were going to get. I'm perfectly clear. Yeah. So in the realm of social media, I guess when you see what's happening for small brewers right now, which I think are a lot of them are kind of engaging in commercial social media for the first time ever. Any advice you'd give them on their first kind of foray into how to use these tools?
Don't post willy-nilly. Have some sort of plan, even if it's not a major plan. Have some sort of idea of what kind of tone you want to present. A lot of your customers are going to know about your team and your beer. So start with those. Be consistent. And you're going to have haters, so you're going to have to figure out how far you're willing to go. Give them one or two comments and then move on. Don't engage them.
How come? I'm paying you for this therapy session now. That's what's happening.
At that point, it just becomes kind of a pissing war.
Yeah, it sure does.
It just feeds into that ego of the troll or the person who just, again, who's so witty. And you lose your focus, and then it sticks up there so much longer when you've got this back and forth. Then if you just let it go, it'll slide out of people's feeds, and it'll be done with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting the way the algorithm has shifted in the past year has been pretty dramatic for that kind of thing. Like it used to be, it would only show one or two kind of responses to something, and then the rest would be buried. But now it kind of keeps resurfacing things if it finds that they're still active and it keeps showing them to people. And so any of that residual activity just gets bumped up to the top of people's feeds again. Changes the dynamic quite a bit. It certainly changes the risk profile of engaging with those people.
Yep. Yeah, we talked a little bit about Goose Island the week before. And what I really do like about what they do is that they're very clear in their responses and they have a little bit of fun. But again, they don't get into things too deeply.
Any breweries that you look to that really set the bar for you?
I am a fan of Pipeworks and their attitude. They're a little bit feisty, but they're not rude. They show off their team.
They're not trying to fight people.
No.
They're a little feisty, but they're not trying to fight people.
And they have a beer cat, so you can't go wrong in my mind if they have a beer cat.
Fair enough. That's a good distinction, though, the difference between feisty and fighting people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm. You can be like a little snotty, but not then. I don't think they ever really engage with anyone. They were active on Beer Advocate for a while, like when they were first starting out. They were taking a lot of questions and answers on Beer Advocate, and then they've almost completely backed away from Beer Advocate. And now it's mostly like, listen, we're super transparent. Everything's on Facebook, everything's on Twitter, everything's in our newsletter. We send out an email newsletter, it's all in there. There's no reason to really talk to us on Beer Advocate anymore because you're just, like, all those simple questions like, when's this beer coming out, are in the newsletter. And then if you're angry at us, we don't really care anymore. Like, unless there's a real problem. Unless there's like an actual, like an infection of a beer or something happened. But other than that, they don't seem to really engage with those people anymore.
What about accounts that take a pretty dramatic turn? Like Three Floyds has recently taken a pretty dramatic turn, like towards being super friendly and informative.
I think they hired someone.
Yeah.
They definitely seem to they hired someone.
I accosted one of their salespeople who I know at a tap room the other night, and I asked her directly what's going on. And she just kind of smiled and walked away.
Weird. It's all they did was get a social media presence. I mean, they went from not having one at all. It's not like the one that they had was bad or weird or too heavy metal or anything. It was, they just were like, hey, we got more zombie dust. And then people go, when are you gonna get more zombie dust? Now they have like an actual social media person who's like, hey, we made zombie dust. Here's a picture of all the zombie dust we made. Come down and get the zombie dust.
Yeah.
It's nice.
It shifts things. Have you ever had to try and turn a voice for a company before, Kate?
That is not something I've had to do.
Yeah.
I can imagine the challenge behind that. Especially if somebody really enjoyed the voice before.
Yeah, fair. It'd be a big shift. But you do look for ways to pull it out of them, right? Like who they want to be, what they want to sound like. Mm-hmm. What is that process like for you? How do you go about doing that?
Well, we very often find that the first one you figure out is always wrong.
Is that right? Why is that?
Well, and this is speaking in the B2B world where you think you're selling to one person and you find that person has minimal interest in the product and that's why they're not responding. So then you have to go and find yourself who the real customer is.
Hmm.
So
is it always true that the people who are responding are the real customer?
I'd say it's probably half and half.
Yeah.
Because like there's people out there who are just going to engage because they want to see if they can get free product.
Yes. I guess when I'm thinking about beer, I'm thinking about like the people who are most active on beer Twitter are probably not the people going to the breweries that they're talking about all the time. Like they're not necessarily the customer. They're just, we hear it a lot in beer. Yeah. They're interested in the engagement or the debate, mm-hmm. or we often hear in beer that they're the vocal minority, but they don't actually become your customer base if you're a local brewery. I don't know. I think it's hard for breweries to figure out right now who their actual customer is based on who's engaging with them online. It's not always the same.
Yeah. Well, especially when there are so many breweries now, and to figure out where your niche is.
Right.
Is
that's a whole different scenario. That's a tough one. Not only how are you going to speak and engage with the world, but about what, right? Because you're making an IPA, that's probably not going to cut it. Yeah.
Yeah. And if you're a small brewery and you have, you know, three people, then you just kind of get whatever you get. And it might be the voice of the brewer is the best option, but you can't get the voice of the brewer because he's busy brewing.
Right. Yeah, that's tricky. Oh, I mean,
or she, shouldn't say he.
we always want, I don't know, I tend to follow a lot of brewers specifically, not breweries.
Those always end up feeling better to follow the people at the brewery than the social media account. And I agree when the breweries are really small, when it's just like three or four people, usually there's not even enough time in the day to run on Facebook and Twitter anything more than like, here's what's on tap tomorrow. Here's what's on tap today. So if you follow the brewers, you get usually an even more inside look, right? Cause like they're going to take pictures of what they're brewing. They're going to take pictures of the finished products, stuff that's probably may never even make it onto the proper brewery's channels because by then they've already taken the picture of it. And they're like, well, I'm not going to do this twice.
Yeah. Or it's just not fit for consumption with a larger audience. I don't know.
That too?
Not going to post the stuff they're drinking from other breweries on their main brewery feed.
Sure. But following...
How many pictures of PBR you think a craft brewer is going to post on their brewer feed?
All of them. following the brewers at Three Floyds showed really early peaks at Dark Lord Day stuff this year. Like, the Dark Lord Day Twitter account was like kind of quiet, and the Three Floyds account really wasn't fully active yet. But follow a couple of the brewers, and you saw bottles, you saw T-shirts. Like, they were taking pictures of the stuff as it was coming in. It's like a little, yeah, little secret.
You got to do a little digging to find those. Well, what's next for you, Kate? You got any beer events coming up that you're going to, or any beers that you're seeking out? Anything you're going to wait in a line for? You got more Hennepins you got to crush?
My, I got some Oktoberfest that has to wait until September. So
it's the rules.
My friends pick on me because I'm one of those people who doesn't like to drink out of season.
Okay, that's just a lot of people. That's a lot of people that don't like to do that. But you already bought it.
It was given to me as a gift for my birthday because they wanted to harass me.
What do we got? Whose is it?
It's just a Sam Adams Oktoberfest.
Ah, one of the best.
Yeah,
that is one of the best. So you're just gonna let that sit in the fridge until September.
I might sneak one or two here or there.
That's some patience.
Don't check them into Untappd. No one will know if you don't untap.
I won't check in on Untappd, so no one will tell. No one will know.
Yeah. Well, thanks for joining us. Appreciate you joining us the second time after we lost the first one. It was fun to talk to you.
All right. Have a good night.
Thanks to the members of the Fervent Few, whose subscriptions directly fund GBH's content. If you'd like to support GBH, we use Patreon as a way that our readers and listeners can subscribe with a monthly contribution, just like subscribing to a magazine. If you want to join, visit patreon.com/goodbeerhunting, or click on the link on our show notes. And Guinness, for their underwriting contributions. If you'd like to inquire about underwriting support for GBH, get in touch via the website or email underwriting@goodbeerhunting.com. Our music is produced by Andrew Thibodeau, and our sound engineer is Jordan Stalling of Particle Audio. Aim true, pour liberal. Have a great week.